I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. With the pre-dawn arrest today of Roger Stone, yet another close associate of President Donald Trump has been indicted by special counsel Robert Mueller. To date, Mr. Trump's campaign chairman, his personal lawyer, and his first national security advisor have pled guilty or been convicted of crimes, and they will likely spend time in prison. Others further out in the Trump circle have been convicted and sentenced as well. But has Mr. Trump himself committed the kinds of high crimes and misdemeanors that would merit his impeachment from office? Even before today's dramatic developments, calls for impeaching the president have begun to grow louder and more frequent. Today on Midday, the case for and against impeachment. Yoni Applebaum of The Atlantic says yes. Yasha Monk of Slate.com argues that long-term, impeachment is a bad idea. They join me right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome to this Friday edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. First, as you have undoubtedly heard, some developments today in the Mueller investigation. The FBI arrested Roger Stone early this morning at his home in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. FBI agents were seen removing items from that location as well as from an apartment that he maintains in New York. Stone has been indicted by a grand jury in the District of Columbia on 7 counts related to his contacts with WikiLeaks during the 2016 campaign. WikiLeaks, of course, stole emails from the Democratic National Committee and John Podesta, the chairman of the Clinton campaign, and they released them at regular intervals during the campaign. Stone is one of 35 people, including Americans and Russians, to have been charged with crimes by special counsel Robert Mueller. Stone, along with Paul Manafort, Michael Cohen, and Michael Flynn, were considered close advisors to Donald Trump. Manafort, Cohen, and Flynn have pleaded guilty or have been convicted of various crimes. They are facing prison sentences. Today on Midday, a conversation about whether or not President Trump himself has committed the high crimes and misdemeanors that the Constitution elucidates as a reason for Congress to impeach him. Mr. Trump's fitness for office has been questioned by people of all political stripes, including, according to multiple reports, several people who worked directly with him in the White House. Questions have been raised about violations of the Emoluments Clause and his demands of loyalty from his Attorney General and the Director of FBI, among others. The president has amassed a legal team of 35 lawyers to respond to subpoenas from Congress and to navigate responses to inquiries from the Office of the Special Counsel. In addition, the Trump campaign, the president's charitable foundation, and other aspects of Mr. Trump's behavior before and while he has been in office are also under investigation. Is all of this enough to justify the initiation of impeachment proceedings against the president? And even if it is enough, should Congress take the dramatic step of considering articles of impeachment against a man who was duly elected just 2 years ago? In an essay in The Atlantic, Yoni Applebaum makes the case that Congress should impeach Mr. Trump. Yoni Applebaum is a historian and a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he oversees the ideas section. He is the author of the cover story in the March issue. It's called The Case for Impeachment. He joins us on the line from the offices of The Atlantic in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Yoni.
Hey, nice to be with you.
Yasha Monk is a scholar at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and the Agora Institute. He has published a kind of rebuttal to Dr. Applebaum's story in The Atlantic, which was posted on Slate.com on Wednesday. It's called The Case Against Impeachment. Dr. Monk joins us on the line from his office in Washington as well. Yasha, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
And listeners, if you'd like to weigh in, I got a funny feeling that a few of you might just want to do that. Our conversation here on Midday, you can be with us by phone at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle at @MiddayWYPR. So, Yoni Applebaum, let me start with you and establish at least one thing that I think you and Yasha Monk agree on, and that is whether or not Mr. Trump is, in fact, fit to serve as president. I think you agree that he is not.
Yeah, I think Yasha and I actually agree on a fair amount here. The case against Donald Trump's fitness to serve as president is one that I think has been most articulated most effectively articulated by members of his own party and officials from within his own administration. And so we had, during the Republican primaries, a series of party elders within the GOP step forward and say, this man is not representing American ideals. His policy proposals, his rhetoric, his conduct are incompatible with the duties and responsibilities of the presidency. Since he's taken office, we've had a series of high-level exits from the administration where folks have stepped out and said, judge us in our time in office, not by what we accomplished or helped the president accomplish, but what we prevented the president from doing. Most recently, John Kelly, the former chief of staff, made this claim as he left the White House. And then sort of rounding it out, we have a series of incidents involving Donald Trump in office where he has issued instructions to members of his cabinet and to senior staff that they've had to go back to him and say, Mr. President, I can't do that. That is illegal, or this is not conduct which is acceptable in a president of the United States. All of this is remarkable. And in some sense, what's most remarkable is that it is there in plain sight. And in the quiet corners of Washington, it is fairly undisputed. It is those with the most direct experience of governance who are most alarmed by how this president is governing.
And Yasha Monk, if that's true, and you certainly state that you don't believe Mr. Trump is fit to serve as well in the piece that you wrote in Slate, if there's consensus about that among at least a certain large segment of the political political class and citizenry, is there, do you think, consensus on whether or not the president has committed offenses that could be considered impeachable?
Well, I think the big question is whether there's consensus among whom. If you ask people in the quiet corners of Washington, they agree. If you ask scholars of political science who actually understand what kind of behavior is a danger to the survival of democracy, they mostly agree. If you ask Yoni and I, we certainly agree. But, of course, impeachment is ultimately a political process. You need a majority in the House of Representatives in order to start impeachment proceedings. And then you need 67 senators to vote to actually convict the president of the charges that are laid against him. I think what's quite clear is that at the moment, Republicans in Congress, including in the Senate, are standing by Donald Trump on virtually everything. They are not even making any real substantial moves to stop him from declaring a fake national emergency, as he seems to be considering at the moment. And so, the one piece of consensus you don't have in this country is the consensus we would need in order for impeachment to succeed. And that's something that we should take seriously when we think about this, not from a moral perspective, on which Yoni and I completely agree, not just from a legal perspective, on which we mostly agree, but from a strategic perspective. What actually would be the impact of indicting Donald Trump on impeachment charges at the moment? Would it actually help to limit the damage he can do? And would it, most importantly, help save this country, not just from Donald Trump himself, but from the specter of Trumpism? And there, I unfortunately am quite skeptical.
And Yoni Applebaum, you argue that the result, meaning whether or not the Senate would actually convict the president of any articles of impeachment that the House would bring to them, is somewhat irrelevant. It doesn't matter. The process of developing that case, the process of finding out what those articles of impeachment might be, in and of itself, is a worthy result.
Right. Or although I think that the result will be consequential, that the benefits of the process will stand irrespective of the result. And one way I think to think about this is to reframe impeachment not as it's commonly deployed as sort of an outcome. Should the president of the United States be removed from office tomorrow, in which case we can debate the plausibility of that outcome and the consequences, but instead to start thinking about it as a process. And here I would point back to past impeachment inquiries into presidents like Andrew Johnson and Richard Nixon, which were not quick. They involved a long, detailed process, and it proceeds in stages. So the first thing that the Congress typically does is it passes a resolution authorizing within the House, authorizing an impeachment inquiry into the president. And it does that for a few reasons. One is it needs to empower a particular committee to look into this. A second is that committee is going to need staff. There is no committee within the House of Representatives which ordinarily pursues the possibility of removing a president of the United States from office. And so they need to hire up lawyers. They need investigators. They need, as the Nixon committee had, a bipartisan staff of dedicated civil servants who are capable of coming in, assembling evidence, interviewing witnesses, asking questions. And as they do that, it yields a number of distinct and compelling benefits. The first is a process of discernment and discovery. So we want to be able to separate the wild, scurrilous, and conspiratorial charges that have been leveled against this president from the ones that have a substantial basis in evidence. And there is no way to do that. We certainly can't do it on this program. You can't do it on a cable news panel. You can't do it by holding a press conference on the steps of the Capitol. You've got to actually do the work. And Congress has outsourced that work to prosecutors, and it ultimately can't do that. The second benefit it yields is it shifts the public conversation. At the moment, the president tweets and the media twitches, and the president drives the conversation. And many things that are among the most disqualifying acts this president has committed instantly or almost instantly recede from public view. If Congress holds a series of hearings, allows the American people to hear directly from witnesses, presents into the public record the evidence, it shifts the terms of the public debate. That becomes what's driving the conversation. Even that process is likely to have a restraining effect on this president, or at least it has had a restraining effect on every president who has faced this kind of inquiry, because they spend their time responding and monitoring the investigation itself, because they become concerned about their own political future. An ordinary hearing in Congress, a president risks only embarrassment with impeachment, that they risk their political future. And so it also helps the president exercise restraint. You know, another thing that it does is it puts this fight where it belongs. We live in an extraordinarily divided polity. Periodically, that spills over into violence. It is having a radicalizing effect. Because Congress has refused to act and trigger impeachment proceedings, it's distorting every branch of our government. So we have lots of unelected bureaucrats who are routinely disregarding presidential orders because they think the president is unfit to issue them, or that they have not been well considered, or they run contrary to the national interest. That's not a healthy system, to have the democratically elected president routinely resisted by members of his own administration who he himself has appointed, their authority derives from him. You also have the courts routinely enjoining actions of this administration because of the president's evident malice. Those are precedents that will stand and be applied against future presidents, constraining their ability to act on behalf of the American people. Because Congress won't ask this question itself, we're finding other branches of government, which are not supposed to be making these sorts of political judgments, instead intervening and acting to restrain the president. And so we have a very unhealthy status quo. And to the extent that we can shift the debate into Congress, I think we'll all benefit.
And Yasha Monk, what about that? The fact that, the Mueller investigation is, in many people's reckoning, doing the work that perhaps Congress should be doing. Is it a bad idea for the investigation to be out of the hands of Congress and into the hands of a special counsel instead?
Well, I certainly think that both of those things should be going on. So I think the special counsel's investigation, which after all is a potentially criminal investigation, is very important. But it may well be that the president has done things which disqualify him from the office of a president of the United States without being easily indictable in front of a federal grand jury. And so the House of Representatives absolutely needs to hold him to account for any misdeeds, look into any of his connections to Russia, demand to see his tax returns. Now, all of that can be done through a normal investigative committee, which is not preparing impeachment charges. So the question is, should Congress be looking into allegations of serious malfeasance by the president? Of course it should. A different question is, should it be starting impeachment proceedings? And there, Yoni and I have our important disagreement. Yoni makes a compelling case for all the kinds of benefits that might flow from an impeachment proceeding. I have some disagreements about that. I find it unlikely, for example, that the political temperature in this country would sink rather than increase if there was impeachment proceedings. And so the idea that impeachment makes political violence less likely seems far-fetched to me. But some of the benefits he talks about may well materialize. The truth is, nobody quite knows. When Newt Gingrich initiated impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton, most people thought it would hugely damage his popularity. It ended up doing the opposite. There certainly is the historical example of Richard Nixon losing a lot of popularity over the course of impeachment proceedings and a lot of Republicans moving towards being willing to impeach him. But there's a crucial difference, which is that Nixon showed a very respectable face to the world and did all of his worst things in private. With Donald Trump, a lot of the things we have reason to be concerned about are perfectly open, and people are already aware of the charges that are laid against him. So it's far less clear that further information about this would actually influence people's opinions. So I want to go back to my two lodestars here. My interest, and I'm very upfront about this, is to remove Donald Trump from office because I do think that he is unfit to serve, and is to make sure that the kind of politics he represents, the kind of attacks on the Constitution which he is willing to carry out, don't have a political future after him. Now, in my mind, by far and away, the best way of accomplishing that is to beat Donald Trump in a landslide fair and square in 2020. We don't know what the impact of impeachment is going to be, but there's two basic scenarios. The first is that impeachment proceedings fail, that in the end, 45 Republican senators say, no, we do not vote to impeach him. In that case, Donald Trump could claim to have been vindicated. He might well have spent the previous year and a half trolling Democrats in Congress every day, something that he's incredibly expert at. And since I think that at the moment the chances of beating Donald Trump in 2020 are very strong, I don't think it's in the interest of his opponents to roll the dice on whatever spectacle impeachment proceedings might turn into.
Let me ask you to just take a quick pause there, and we're going to pick up that argument when we come back from a quick break. Yasha Monk is an associate professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the author of a piece on Slate.com called The Case Against Impeachment. He hosts the Good Fight podcast on Slate, and he's the author of the book The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. Yoni Applebaum is the senior editor at The Atlantic, where he oversees the ideas section. He's the author of The Atlantic March cover story headlined The Case for Impeachment. When we come back, we'll take your calls, questions, and emails. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To drop us a tweet, it's @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on our program, a look at the Legislative Black Caucus's 2019 agenda for the Maryland General Assembly session, and an interview with Wanda Draper. She's the outgoing director of the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. That's all coming up Monday on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about whether or not Congress should initiate an impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump's actions and fitness for office. My guests today are Yoni Applebaum. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic. He oversees the ideas section, and he's the author of the March cover story headlined The Case for Impeachment. Yasha Monk is an associate professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's also a columnist at Slate and the host of the Good Fight podcast. He has published an essay in Slate, published a couple of days ago. It's called The Case Against Impeachment. You are welcome to join our conversation. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can find me @TomHall. WYPR. So, Yasha, let me go back to you. I had to interrupt you because I'm beholden to the tyranny of the clock here on the program. talk a little bit more about the political calculation that perhaps needs to be made, because a lot of folks are saying a political calculation is really the last thing that Congress needs to consider. Whether or not people support it or not isn't Congress's business. What is Congress's business is if they see evidence of malfeasance in office, they should address it.
Well, so I agree with that entirely. The constitutional duty of every congressman and every senator is not to think about their re-election. It's certainly not to think about the interests of their political party. It is to uphold the oath of office. Now, from my perspective, if I were a Republican senator, I would feel obliged to vote to impeach Donald Trump, most likely, depending on exactly how the proceedings would go. But at this point, I would think it is likely that the case can be made that they have a strong moral obligation to vote for impeaching Donald Trump. But nevertheless, there's a question to be asked about whether initiating impeachment proceedings would actually work. Is it actually going to save us from a real danger for the most basic political institutions in our country? And there's lots of evidence from other countries, and I'm somebody who studies comparative political science. I look at the rise of populism in lots of different countries around the world, and there's lots of evidence that a botched impeachment proceeding can actually empower the dangerous person in office. This certainly happened with a violent coup in Turkey in 2016. It also happened with a perfectly legal recall referendum against Hugo Chavez in 2003, and we're seeing in the news every day at the moment just how disastrous the long-term consequences of that have been.
Yeah, and Yoni Applebaum, I mean, what about that point? I mean, you make the point in your piece that if the impeachment debate were put where it belongs, which is in Congress rather than in, you know, the public sphere on CNN or on NPR or Fox News, that it would lower the temperature and the political polarity that the country has been, you know, really convulsed by for the last several years. What makes you think that would be the case? I mean, if there were impeachment proceedings happening every day on television, wouldn't the cable coverage and the news coverage just be all the more intense? And doesn't that run the risk of making this bifurcated political system even more apart?
Oh, I think it would absolutely inflame the public debate. I think what I'd say is that impeachment focuses those passions on a process where both sides can have their say, where the witnesses can be cross-examined, where there's a common evidentiary basis that we're debating. We've got this right now. We have political violence in this country. We have an extraordinarily rancorous debate. We have a polity that seems driven more by partisan or even personal allegiance than by policy preferences. These are already features of our political landscape. The question is what you do about it. You can go on and allow one side to listen to Fox and the other side to whatever they're listening to, CNN, and hope that eventually, as Yasha hopes, that there's some sort of electoral resolution to all of this. But I think there's a few risks in sort of Congress sitting on its hands here and deciding to make a tactical play that if it just waits out this president, he can be defeated at the polls and that will be for the best. The first of those risks is that Congress will be abrogating its constitutional duty. It has a responsibility here. It's really, I think, not in dispute by House Democrats or even by many Republicans that we're well past the threshold for triggering this kind of inquiry. And I don't think it does a great deal to feed public confidence in institutions to watch Congress regularly go on news shows and level charges against the president and yet sit on its hands.
But let me
it
ask,
looks cynical
let me ask,
and it looks calculated.
Let me ask you to qualify that. What makes you think that there are a number of Republicans who think that we're well past the threshold for an impeachment inquiry? I mean, I'm not hearing that from anybody in the Senate, certainly, and very few people in Congress.
Well, it's not up to the Senate, and I think that that this would be a long process before any of it arrived in the Senate. But I do think that what you will hear in public statements is not what is said privately, that there are political calculations, as Yasha points out, that have kept this on the sidelines. The House Democrats don't actually need any Republican support to start this process. This is a president who commands the allegiance of Congress, not out of love, but out of fear that they are correctly concerned that their constituents hold the president in higher esteem than they tend to hold their local U.S. congressman or senator, and so that they are reluctant to act openly. But that's not to say, and you can see this from any number of things they said during the campaign when they didn't yet think that Donald Trump would be the nominee or when they believed he wouldn't be elected, from indirect statements that many of them have made, drawing sharp contrasts between their visions of the country and the ones coming from the president. They're not willing to attack him openly, but it doesn't take very much tea leaf reading to see that there is some support for this conclusion, even if there isn't the political will to act. But
Yoni, let me just remind folks who we're talking to and what we're talking about. Yoni Applebaum is a senior editor at The Atlantic. He's written a very compelling piece in the March issue. The cover story is called The Case for Impeachment. Yasha Monk has written an equally compelling piece in Slate.com called The Case Against Impeachment. You're listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet. It's @MiddayWYPR. And gentlemen, let me go to the phones if we can. Jesse in West Baltimore, thanks for calling. You oppose an inquiry regarding impeachment. How come?
Yes. Although, Tom, I'm a Democrat and I just about disagree with everything that President Trump does or says, I don't think initiating an impeachment proceeding, which is basically an indictment in secular terms against him, is good for three reasons. One, I think it would backfire. I think that the Democrats have learned from the 1990s, as your guest alluded to. The Democrats have learned from the Republicans who impeached President Clinton in the 90s that this could backfire. And so I think that they run the risk of making Trump a martyr. That's the first reason. Two, I think it would just be too disruptive to the nation. I think with the arrest of Roger Stone, Mr. Cohen, Flynn, I think Trump will implode, or his administration and all that has taken place during or before he became president. So I think time is unfolding and he will implode. And the third reason is, given the Republican majority in the Senate, I mean, if the House initiates an indictment or impeachment, it goes to the Senate for a trial, he's not going to be convicted, or whatever the term is in this instance. So it's just be a waste of time. And again, it'll just be too disruptive. We're already too polarized. So I think that the Congress should hold him accountable, but I think that time will tell, and just let this administration just implode. And hopefully in 2020, the American people will have awakened and just not vote him to be president again.
Okay, well, thanks for that comment, Jesse. And Yasha Monk, when it comes to this political calculation as to whether it works or doesn't, what do we learn from the Nixon impeachment, or for that matter, from the Andrew Johnson impeachment in the 19th century, or the Clinton impeachment? I mean, when Jesse suggests that, it could backfire, Mr. Clinton survived it. He became once again pretty popular, but Yoni Applebaum makes the case that Al Gore had a very difficult time getting elected after him because of that proceeding. And of course, in the case of Mr. Nixon, he resigned. I mean, what are the lessons of history in the other three impeachments that have occurred in American history?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that you should have had Jesse on instead of me, because he made the point excellently. Look, I think there's two basic scenarios, right? We don't know what impeachment is going to look like, but we know that Donald Trump will either be removed from office through impeachment or he will survive the vote. So let's go through those two scenarios. If he survives the vote, then obviously the most important purpose of impeachment has failed, which is to remove somebody who is dangerous to our Constitution, to our constitutional government, from power. I also think it will likely have done a second damage, which is that Donald Trump could then say that he has been vindicated, that he has proven that all of the charges laid against him are wrong. Now, of course, that is not what it would in fact have meant, but he would be able to make a very strong argument for that. At the moment, his approval ratings lie below 40%. Democrats have shown that they can beat him quite strongly in the midterms. So betting markets give Donald Trump only about a 30% chance of getting reelected. I think if he survived an impeachment proceedings, that could likely go up. But the historical point is just as important about the second one. What actually happens if he is removed, or if he is so weakened by the impeachment proceedings that that's what makes him crash out of the political system, which was the situation of Andrew Johnson in the 19th century, and Yoni invokes him in his piece. Well, I fear that then we might have a political martyr, somebody who can say, I actually have the support of a majority of the American population. I was elected fair and square when all of these elites ran around and did their games on me and they removed me from power. And this kind of martyrdom can fuel a political movement for a very long time. So impeachment proceedings managed to essentially remove Andrew Johnson from office. He just survived the vote, but he was so weakened that he couldn't run for re-election. But his basic political project, which was to turn America into a white man's republic again, to essentially erase all of the gains of Reconstruction, triumphed within 10 or 15 years of those impeachment proceedings. And my biggest fear is that this could happen right now, that Donald Trump is somehow removed from office, but Trumpism lives.
And Yoni Applebaum, you make a very good point in your piece that the language of the Constitution calls for crimes and high crimes and misdemeanors to be taken into consideration by Congress. But you make the point that they don't actually have to be felonies. They don't have to be the kinds of crimes that, you know, Michael Cohen's been convicted of, or Michael Flynn has been convicted of, or Manafort. They can be things that are not convictable in a court of law.
Yeah, so a high crime and misdemeanor, not all criminal acts are high crimes and misdemeanors, and not all high crimes and misdemeanors are criminal acts. It's a term of art adopted into the Constitution by the founders from an English background, and it essentially, if you want a shorthand, they are betrayals of the office that and the duties of the office that endanger democracy. And so, that's a pretty high bar for what kinds of acts are going to get over it. But, that there's often this sort of futile search for the one technical legal violation that you could charge a president with, when in fact that's not what the framers had in mind. But I want to step back for just a second and think about the case that your caller, Jesse, made very well, because it accurately reflects the Democrats' thinking. I think the leadership is scarred by the battles of the 90s. If you think that the things that Donald Trump stands accused of are effectively equivalent to the things that Bill Clinton stood accused of, then that is a good parallel to draw. I don't happen to think that there's all that much similarity between the two cases. I think that the charges against Trump are a heck of a lot closer to those facing Richard Nixon or Andrew Johnson, and that's why I look there for guidance. But if you think that all this is a second Clinton impeachment, then fine. You know, I'm disarmed. I have no further arguments to make. But there was no process with Clinton. There were no hearings. Congress took a gift wrap report from a special prosecutor, heard only from Ken Starr, the sole witness to testify before that inquiry, and moved ahead with impeachment. So I look at the Clinton case not as a cautionary tale for Democrats about what can go wrong, so much as a case study in how not to handle the process. That the benefits here accrue from handling a legal and orderly process and handling it well. And in the Clinton impeachment, we had no process whatsoever, and it was handled extraordinarily poorly. So, to the extent that people want to draw a lesson from that, I think it's the opposite of the one that many Americans who naturally reach back to that as sort of their experience of impeachment are drawing, and they're not looking back to these other examples. And if they did, I think they'd draw a very different set of lessons from this, which is that impeachment is effective as a process irrespective of the outcome. And actually, I'd part ways with Yasha here. There was a little ellipsis there where 10 or 15 years go by before we roll back Reconstruction. We don't get vigorous Reconstruction without the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. That is what rallies public support for racial equality in the United States. It radicalizes much of the opposition, just as Donald Trump today is radicalizing the opposition. And you get much more support for racial equality. You get a program of Reconstruction which lasts a decade or more. It is, in fact, defeat at the polls that will overturn that. So it's not that impeachment somehow radicalizes the opposition to racial equality and ends Reconstruction. Quite the opposite. It is impeachment which rallies support for Reconstruction. And it is the slow erosion of that support over time, but specifically the failure of Congress to step in when people do break the laws, when there is widespread lynchings and violence that disrupt elections, when the election of a president and its legitimacy really is in doubt in 1876, and Congress doesn't act. It is that failure to act which ends Reconstruction, not the other way around.
Yoni Applebaum is a senior editor at The Atlantic and the author of their March cover story, which has garnered lots of conversation, including the one we're having right now. It's called The Case for Impeachment. Yasha Monk is an associate professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a columnist at Slate.com. His latest piece for Slate is called The Case Against Impeachment. You are welcome to join us when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. Quick break. When we return, we'll have more with Yasha Monk and Yoni Applebaum. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're examining whether or not President Donald Trump should be impeached. My guests do not disagree with the assertion that Mr. Trump is unfit to serve. There are many people of both major political parties who agree on that point as well. Their conversation, begun in essays that they've published in The Atlantic and Slate.com, is around whether or not impeachment is the right remedy and whether or not now is the right time to initiate impeachment proceedings. And by the way, we should remember that only one member of the Democratic congressional leadership, Representative James Clyburn of South Carolina, has endorsed efforts by rank-and-file Democrat members to begin impeachment proceedings. Speaker Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi of California, has said she will not pursue impeachment, certainly at this time. Yoni Applebaum is a senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us on the line from Washington. He thinks Mr. Trump should be impeached and that an inquiry should begin right away. Also joining us from Washington, Yasha Monk. His essay in Slate.com argues that Congress should not impeach Donald Trump. Mr. Trump's approval ratings have declined significantly since the partial government shutdown began last month. The shutdown is now in its 35th day. If you are a supporter of the president and if you think that he's done nothing to merit the consideration of impeachment, we would love to hear from you. If you think Mr. Trump should be impeached or if you think that the spectacle of impeachment would harm the country, we'd love to hear from you as well. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can also drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. We have an email from Stan who says Mr. Trump has harassed women, groped them, and then had them paid to keep quiet before the election. He has also broken the emoluments clause of the Constitution. These seem definitely impeachable offenses. In addition to his being incompetent and dangerous for the country and the world, we need to convince Republicans to put the country above party. Let's go to the phones. Peter in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Yes, how you doing? Thank you.
And what's on your mind, sir?
Thank you for answering my call.
Sure.
Yes. I have to say just one thing. Why is it and how is it possible that the President of the United States has the right to shut the country down, the government down? People need jobs, and it's going to really get worse when people can't pay their bills. I'm a retired person. I don't have a job. I get my Social Security. But I sympathize with what's happening with the government now. He's shutting the government down, and then it's going to get worse, and then there will be violence. So that's why he should be impeached.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Peter. And Yoni Applebaum, you know, you can hear the passion in Peter's voice about that. The Washington Post just reported less than an hour ago that 14,000 workers at the IRS did not show up for work today and that the processing of tax returns is going to be greatly impeded. LaGuardia Airport is delaying or deferring flights because of a lack of air traffic controllers. I mean, but those are not the kinds of things, however, that Congress could imagine in an impeachment proceeding, are they not?
No, they're probably not, but I think that they're a very good indication of what's going wrong in that the fight between Mr. Trump and Speaker Pelosi is in part a fight over the president's legitimacy and his border wall, and these things become proxy fights. It's very hard to have an ordinary function in government when the opposition fundamentally believes that the president and his agenda are illegitimate. And so because Congress will not move forward with an impeachment inquiry, because it won't put this stuff on the table directly, we get, and we're going to go on getting, a long series of proxy fights of games of chicken between Congress and the president. And I think this is going to be our lived reality for the next 2 years, unless Congress is willing to take action and put this where it belongs.
Let's go back to the phones to Roger in Hagerstown. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for receiving my phone call. I'm listening intently to this conversation. And I feel that in reference to Bill Clinton, I didn't see any national defense issues that were critical when Bill Clinton was impeached. I do see that now. And my concern is, if we don't do something in the way in which they do in England as a vote of non-confidence, if you don't show, if this government does not show the American people they're concerned about the future of this country and that we can't wait till 2020 to have another election. Because look at the past election we just had. We're still investigating Russian influence. So what would it be like in 2020? And also, it will give the Republicans an opportunity to choose someone else to run for election rather than the one that they had to accept. If you remember, when he first ran for election, they weren't really convinced he would even make it. So now it becomes rather an impulsive situation. We have a fellow in office that has no qualms about what to do. An example right now, closes down the government for the past 30-some-odd days, sets a precedent of what he will do when he wants to do something else. And we're the ones that are victimized by this, the people out here in this country.
Well, thanks for that call, Roger. I appreciate it. And Yasha Monk, part of the big issue, not just around the impeachment conversation, but around conversations about virtually every issue that presents itself to the public sphere, is that people don't agree on the facts. People are not working from the same set of assumptions and perceived wisdom. I mean, there is a conservative argument now when it comes to all of these indictments, Cohen and Flynn and Stone and et cetera, that these are process crimes and that they're based on the Steele dossier, which has never been verified, and the investigation by Mr. Mueller is a witch hunt. So these are minor things. These have nothing to do with serious. Malfeasance. If people don't agree on the basic assumptions of whether or not the president is acting in a deleterious way towards the country, how could anybody ever come to any consensus about whether he should be in or out of office?
Well, so this is exactly my fear. And there, I think it's very important to speak to how today's situation is different from the situation we had at the time of the Nixon impeachment hearing. Now, with Richard Nixon, first of all, the country was less polarized than it is now. Partisan identities went less deep. People had more cross-cutting identities, which meant that perhaps they were conservative, but they also hung out with people who were not conservative at their churches, at their in their neighborhoods. And now the country has sorted itself in a much more radical way. And that makes it harder for people to listen to new information with an open mind than it would have been, 40 years ago. But the other disanalogy is crucial, which is that Richard Nixon did all of the things he did in secret. People did not know about the Watergate burglary. They did not know about the kind of foul language that he used within the White House. It's hard to imagine what new revelation might come out of impeachment proceedings which would move opinion today in the same way as those curse words did on the Nixon tape. If we get access to Donald Trump raving and ranting within the White House, do we really think it would actually change the perception that his supporters have of him? If we found out even more information about the links that his campaign had with Russia, at a time when we already know that one of his closest associates and friends, Roger Stone, that his campaign manager, Paul Manafort, all worked on behalf of foreign interests or perverted the course of justice in substantial ways. I am unfortunately skeptical that however much we objectively discover in the course of impeachment proceedings, it would move opinion to the extent we need in order to ensure that he's actually removed from office.
Yeah, and we're up against the clock, but Yoni Applebaum, you coined the phrase Mueller ex machina with Steve Inskeep yesterday on Morning Edition. In fact, people are waiting for all sorts of revelations. I would take issue with Yasha about whether or not people are concerned about Mr. Trump's use of profanity. I think they're more concerned about his collusion or conspiracy with a foreign government to influence the election. What do you think?
Yeah, I think people would like to know what Robert Mueller knows, but they'd also like to know a whole lot else. They'd like to know what's in the president's tax returns, and he hasn't released those. They'd like to know about his financial conflicts. There is value in putting this stuff out there in public. The public is divided. There were more than 4,000 domestic terror attacks the year Richard Nixon took office. It was divided then, too. But putting the evidence out there in public moved the needle in ways that nobody anticipated at a time when Republicans stood rock solid behind Richard Nixon. And I think it might well do the same today. But whether or not it does, there is value in putting that stuff out there, so at least we're debating a common set of facts.
Let's go to see if we can get in one more call. David in Baltimore, welcome to the show. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Tom. The point I wanted to make was that for the last 2 years, the Republican Party has been complicit in allowing Donald Trump to get away with who he's getting away with. And if there were a situation, bizarre as it seems, that the Republicans actually agreed to impeachment and went along with it and actually had the votes in the Senate, and in the Senate, to actually impeach, this would allow the Republicans to get off the hook. It would allow them to cleanse themselves of the taint of Donald Trump, and that's why I am so opposed to this notion of impeachment, because it's not just Donald Trump. It's the complicit Republican Party which has put us to the place where we are right now.
Well, thanks for that call, David. That's an interesting point, Yasha Monk, that, you know, if the Republicans do vote to impeach and remove him from office, they've somehow, you know, cleansed themselves. What do you think?
Well, look, I think it'll be very hard for him to cleanse himself morally. I will always hold him accountable in my mind for what they've done for the last 2 years to enable Donald Trump. But you know what? We will need a center of right party in this country that isn't Trumpist, that stands up for the Constitution. And much as I would have to hold my nose to tolerate that, I'm in favor of anything that leads to that outcome.
And Yoni Applebaum, what about the issue of what Mr. Trump may or may not have done before he was elected? Is that something that is legitimately investigated by Congress?
Certainly Congress can investigate it. There's a split among constitutional scholars about exactly what's impeachable. Financial crimes in the 1980s, probably not. Many scholars think that a crime committed in order to get into office ought to be impeachable, or else simply winning the election becomes an ex post facto justification of whatever it took to get there.
Well, that is all the time we have. And gentlemen, I am very, very grateful to you for the pieces that you've published in the Slate, in Slate.com, in the Atlantic. And this has been a terrific conversation. So thanks to you both. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Yasha Monk is an associate professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's also a columnist at Slate and the host of the Good Fight podcast. His essay in Slate.com is called The Case Against Impeachment. His latest book is called The People Versus Democracy: Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. Yoni Applebaum is a historian and a journalist. He is senior editor at The Atlantic, where he oversees the ideas section, and he's the author of the cover story of the March issue, and it's entitled The Case for Impeachment. Before joining The Atlantic, Dr. Applebaum was a lecturer on history and literature at Harvard University. That's it for us today. Coming up on Monday here on Midday, we'll take a look at the agenda for the 2019 Maryland General Assembly of the Legislative Black Caucus. Plus, Wanda Draper, she's the outgoing director of the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. She will join me to talk about where things stand at the Lewis Museum as she ends her tenure there. That's all coming up on Midday Monday. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. Rob Sivak, Sienna Greaves, and Kathleen Cahill produce our program. Jamila Kremple is our digital producer. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. I am grateful to everybody who called. I'm sorry we weren't able to get to all of the calls we got today. I'm grateful to everybody who subscribes to our podcast, who follows us on Twitter at Midday WYPR. You can also follow me on Twitter at Tom Hall WYPR. I'm Tom Hall, and Reveal is up at the top of the hour after the news from NPR. So stay tuned. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.